Sorry?
Can I just check everybody's got their mics on mute, please? Thank you. Right, I'm just going to ask the next question, which is just like where you're delivering your services at the moment. Be really interesting to know which, how, whereabouts organisations are delivering services. So do you, and just write it in. Do you work in a borough? Are you doing pan-London work? Name your borough. Just be really good for Nicola to get an idea of where people are delivering services at this moment in time. That's really useful. Really interesting to know lots of people are delivering online, and we are making assumptions that lots of people are delivering online services at this moment. I think we usually have Cardiff in the house, so I'll be quite depressed if Cardiff aren't actually in the house, because normally what happens is Cardiff City Football Club, I think, have been on everything we've done in the last 6 months, which, given the fact we're a London-based organisation, I love it. It makes me laugh, though, I have to say. Right, so we've got a really good cross-section of boroughs, local authorities, pan-London, across the country. That's absolutely great. We do have Wales in the house. It might be Cardiff City Football Club, so I might have to get them to announce themselves in the chat. What I will say is this is a series of four sessions. Nicola's going to talk you through that in a minute. And if other colleagues of yours are interested in more, is we're about to launch another series which starts in October as well. So if you've got other colleagues in your organisation who'd like to join the training, then just keep an eye on our update services, because actually what we'll be doing is publicising quite a lot of new training sessions as well. That's great. Now, I'm going to stop sharing my screen, but you should be able to carry on entering your data in there. And I'm going to introduce Nicola Lester, who's going to run the session. And Naomi and I from Partnership for Young London are here to give a bit of backup support and just answer your questions in the chat and stuff like that. So Nicola, you should be able to share your screen.
Let me give this a go. Is that shared with everybody?
It's great.
Perfect. Good start. Are you ready for me to get started, Sharon?
Yeah, Nicola, over to you now.
Okay, brilliant. Good morning, everybody. My name's Nicola Lester, and I'm a mental health nurse by background, specialising in working with psychological trauma. Today's session, I'm anticipating, will take about sort of 45 to 50 minutes of teaching. I recognise it's really, really tough to do this on Zoom. So I do want to try and be as interactive as possible, bearing in mind that there's quite a large number of us today. So as Sharon said, do use the chat function, and I'll be checking in periodically through the teaching just to see if there's anything coming up on the chat, or if there's any burning questions, then you can then use that as an opportunity to unmute yourself and to ask questions. We've also left a good sort of half an hour at the end where there'll be an evaluation to complete, but also space and time to ask any questions that you want. And normally what I do is stay on the line at the end, so if anyone wants to kind of wait and ask questions to a smaller audience as well, that opportunity is there as well. Just to say, when I'm delivering the actual teaching session, I am going to turn off my camera simply because I get distracted. Turn off my camera for the majority of the teaching and then switch it back on at the end. So in terms of, as Sharon said, we're running a trauma series which has four sessions over the next few weeks, and these will be focused on an introduction to trauma, which is obviously today's focus of the session. We'll also be looking at developing trauma-informed practice. Some of you I know are from a whole range of different organisations, and you may have already had some trauma-informed practice training previously, but we'll be looking at focusing on that on session two. Session three is focused on developing therapeutic skills and creative ways of working, and particularly in the context of how we might look to do that when we're delivering online services as well, in recognition of some of those real ongoing challenges that you're all facing in your work at the moment. And the fourth session will be focused on what it actually means to become trauma-informed, both individually and also for the organisations that you're working for. The objectives really of this trauma series is to try and be as accessible and informative as we can be, and to combine this kind of theoretical knowledge and the practical skills to enable you to have the confidence to apply a trauma-informed approach to individual and organisational practice. One of the things that I always say at the start of this training is that when we talk about trauma-informed practice, it's not meant to be complicated, and you will find as we go through the series of sessions that many of you are already trauma-informed in your practice. You may not even realise that you are being trauma-informed. So this isn't necessarily about teaching new skills, but it is about providing a framework and giving you the confidence to talk about trauma-informed practice as part of your work. It's also an opportunity to share ideas and ask questions. When we've got large numbers, obviously it's easier to do this via the chat function, but it can also be a really good way of networking as well. And what I'll be sending out at the end of the training session today, and actually every training session, is a copy of the PowerPoint slides so that you have access to the information. And we've also created a trauma-informed practice handbook as a reference guide, which is available as an online resource for you to get more information and to read around some of the ideas that I'm sharing, and hopefully to use that as part of continuing professional development as well. In terms of today's session in particular, what we're looking to do is to really start to underpin our knowledge of trauma. So today's session is quite theory-based and quite heavy on the theory, but we're going to be starting off with thinking about understanding more broadly this term psychological trauma. We're going to be looking specifically at developmental trauma, or what's sometimes called adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. You may have come across in part of your previous training. We'll also cover a concept that you may or may not have come across called post-traumatic growth. And finally, I'll be thinking about self-care and psychological resilience as well, and really trying to contextualize this into what it means to be delivering work at the moment in the context of an ongoing pandemic, when we're still facing daily restrictions from the government, and there's still that level of uncertainty around what the future holds for us individually and also as part of our professional work. So really starting with what is trauma. So trauma is a very specific type of stress that essentially reflects exposure to emotionally distressing events. And what's most important to emphasize here is that when somebody has a trauma response, they are actually having a very normal response to an abnormal event. One of the things that we tend to do when we're working with trauma is we start to judge the event itself. And we say things like, because they've experienced this, they should be traumatized, or because they've experienced that, they shouldn't be traumatized. So if we think about the context of, say, the Manchester Arena bombing, some of you may have seen that that's come up in the news this week as the inquiries started. How people are responding to the effect of that incident is normal. The very fact that a bomb went off at the end of a concert on a Monday night in May in 2017, that's the abnormal thing, not how people are responding to it. And so when we're working with trauma, the focus really needs to be on understanding how someone is responding to the event rather than judging the event itself. And it's really important that we make that distinction, because when we're thinking about trauma responses, what we're looking at is some very subjective, individualized responses, which is how we can have two or three or even hundreds of people experience the same traumatic incident, and all of them will have different reactions. And this is where things start to become stigmatized, when people talk about they can't handle it or they're too weak particularly thinking in military contexts when we're working with, say, for example, military personnel who deploy into an operational environment like Iraq or Afghanistan, they experience an incident and some respond and manage to cope with it, and others find that they need to seek support. So there's a lot of judgment and stigma around the impact of traumatic events. And so it's really important that we remain focused on how someone responds to a trauma rather than judging the event itself. So the word trauma is used to describe experiences or situations that are emotionally painful and distressing and that overwhelm people's ability to cope, leaving them feeling powerless. And as you can see from that very definition, what we're looking at here is very subjective. So what I might find emotionally painful and distressing will be different to somebody else. What overwhelms my capacity to cope and leaves me feeling powerless will be different to somebody else again. And trauma has also sometimes been defined in reference to circumstances that are outside the normal realm of human experience. And again, all of us will have a different idea of what's within our normal realm of human experience. So going back to the military example, I worked with a number of military personnel back in 2010, 2011, at the sort of height of the Afghanistan campaign. And one of the things that we found was that the number of people accessing mental health services after they returned from their operational deployments, largely they came not because of something that they'd seen over in Afghanistan, they came because of the breakdown of a relationship. So because they'd trained and they'd trained throughout, before they were deployed, they'd trained and they'd anticipated that they would experience combat-related trauma by the very nature of their role. They were prepared. So when they experienced traumatic incidents in Afghanistan, it was within their realm of normal human experience. What they'd not anticipated was the breakdown of a relationship back at home. So that became outside of their realm of normal human experience. So just thinking again about how subjective that is for us. I'm going to talk through a couple of theories of trauma just to kind of help give a bit of context. So the first is a theory that we've called the glass jar theory of trauma. So originally this was developed by an RAF psychiatrist who called it the pint glass model. But because I've delivered quite a lot of this training over in the Middle East, we've had to adapt it to a glass jar rather than a pint glass to make it a little bit more culturally appropriate. So this is the idea that when we're born with an empty glass jar inside of us. And gradually, as we go through life, as we experience little stresses and big stresses, little traumas and big traumas, our glass jars start to get more and more full. And what we end up with is a certain amount of liquid in our glass jars. And the space between the top of the liquid and the top of the jar, that then becomes our resilience. So the more trauma and stress and adversity that we've experienced, potentially the less resilience we have. So one of the things when we're working with trauma is that we don't always know how full someone's glass jar is. And we also don't know how full it already is before another traumatic incident happens. So when we're thinking about being trauma informed and we're asking questions about, I wonder what's happened to this person, it's being very mindful that we don't know what's in that glass jar and how much resilience somebody already has in their life and how much space there is for other things to start to fill up that jar. One of the things that's happened, particularly around the pandemic, is that I've been working with a number of organisations who've had to very quickly adjust their services to move to online remote working. And they're still continuing to support people who were already potentially vulnerable before the pandemic, whose glass jars were already fairly full. And then the pandemic came along and then created fuller glass jars. So again, thinking about not only how people are in the here and now because of the pandemic, but also the very reasons they were referred into our services in the first place and the level of vulnerability that they may have already had. The second theory is a theory of shattered assumptions. And this again is the idea that when we're born believing that the world is a safe and good place, and particularly our individual worlds are safe and good until proven otherwise. Now, this happens at different times for different people, depending on their experiences. So if we imagine a child who experiences abuse or neglect or other adverse childhood experiences very early on in their childhood, Their sense of safety in their individual worlds is shattered much earlier. Now, when a child's sense of safety is shattered, what they have to do is recreate a view of the world which takes into account the fact that the world isn't entirely safe, that people can't be trusted, that bad things may happen to them. And so when they recreate their worldview, they start to adopt certain behaviours to help them keep themselves safe. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in the developmental trauma section. The other place where this theory is particularly relevant at the moment is around the impacts of COVID-19. So we're very good at making a distinction between our individual worlds and the world at large. So we can switch on the news and we can see that there is conflict, there is war, there is disaster, there is violence, and there is crime in the world at large, but we still feel that our individual worlds are safe. And we're very good at making that distinction. One of the things that the pandemic has done is it has shattered for all of us our individual view of the world being safe and good. So it's touched all of our lives in one way or another. So over the past 4 or 5 months, all of us have been doing this work to create a view of the world which takes into account that the world isn't entirely safe. And we've had to introduce and integrate different strategies into our world to keep ourselves safe, whether it's those practical things like wearing a face mask, washing our hands more often, carrying hand sanitizer, or not going out and socializing as much, or whether it's psychologically thinking about being on high alert, being very mindful of the people around us. But all of us have had our assumptions of the world being safe and good shattered over the past 5 months. And I'll talk a little bit more about this when we come on to think about our self-care and our psychological resilience. You'll also see I've included a photograph here of an image of some worry dolls. Some of you may be familiar with worry dolls already, and you may already use them in your work. But just to give a bit of background, the indigenous people from the Highlands in Guatemala created worry dolls many generations ago as a kind of remedy for worrying. And according to legend, children tell their worries to worry dolls, and they place them under their pillow at night when they go to bed. And by morning, the dolls have gifted them with the wisdom and knowledge to eliminate their worries. And so in the aftermath of the Manchester bombing, I was working for a Ministry of Justice funded project at the time, and we used worry dolls really extensively when working therapeutically with children to provide them with a way of expressing their fears and anxieties and to seek reassurance and support. For many of the young people who were caught up in the arena attack, their sense of safety was fundamentally shattered, not only for them, but also for their parents. So really finding ways of helping them to express their anxiety and do some of that work to kind of reconstruct a worldview and to support them and reassure them became really important. So in terms of thinking about the impact of trauma, trauma affects everything. It affects how we think, how we learn, how we remember things, the way we feel about ourselves, the way we feel about other people, and ultimately the way we make sense of the world. They're all profoundly altered by traumatic experience. So just thinking about what that means from developmental trauma. So I've touched on this already, thinking about the glass jar and that theory of shattered assumptions in the context of developmental trauma. So what we have in trauma terms is we have kind of broadly definitions of trauma, and then we have something much more specific around developmental trauma. And this is a term which is used to describe childhood trauma from things like chronic abuse, neglect, separation, or indeed any adverse experiences which happen within a child's significant relationships. And although developmental trauma is primarily concerned with the impact on a child's development, it can be really helpful to understand how childhood trauma can then shape the behaviour of adolescents and adults. So even if you're doing work with adolescents or young adults or even older adults, contextualising that in terms of understanding the impact of developmental trauma can be really useful, then to think about how you can integrate a trauma-informed approach to your work. One of the reasons that even though there's been a popularity in the term of adverse childhood experiences, one of the reasons that I've stuck to developmental trauma is because it's a really good reminder that what we're talking about in terms of early childhood trauma is that somebody's development has been affected. The way that the child has developed has been disrupted by the fact that they've experienced trauma. And that's why I continue to refer to it as developmental trauma. And what we're looking at doing through this understanding of developmental trauma is helping us to develop a trauma-informed approach that's centered on asking, what's happened to you? What have your experiences been? What's going on with that trauma jar? As opposed to saying, what's wrong with you? Why are you like this? Why can't you do the same things that other people can do? Why do you cope differently? We're looking to shift that question to help us to understand what someone might have been through, to then help us work with the way that they're presenting in the here and now. So again, if we think about that trauma glass jar and the shattered assumptions, that fits very neatly with developmental trauma in the sense that both of those are thinking about those very early childhood experiences and the impacts of those early childhood experiences. What we know is that early trauma leads to what we sometimes define as unhealthy or dysfunctional coping strategies, but it also limits a child's ability to develop essential skills such as impulse control, containing emotions, and solving problems. This next section is quite heavy on the theory, and one of the things that I'd encourage you to do as I'm talking through the impact of developmental trauma is to be thinking about some of the people that you work with, whether they be children, adolescents, or adults, and thinking about whether or not some of these behaviours may actually ring true for those that you're working with. So when a child is exposed to trauma over a long period of time, they effectively become stuck in what's known as their primitive brain, which is responsible for our survival system. So that flight, fight, or freeze response that we have when we're under danger, that's part of the primitive brain, and they're responsible for our survival systems. When a child gets stuck in this part of the brain, it means that very little information then gets passed to other parts of their brain, which means that they have limited opportunity for developing other skills such as processing information, retaining any new information, reasoning and empathy, and being able to accurately interpret the behaviours of others. So all of these skills that we may have taken for granted as we have grown up and we've reached adolescence and early adulthood, all of these skills that we would take for granted in both ourselves and others, they've not actually had the opportunity to develop when a child has become exposed to trauma very early in their childhood, because they've effectively got stuck in that primitive brain where all of their energy and time is taken up just learning how to survive and just making sure that they can keep themselves safe. So to understand developmental trauma, it's useful to think about the way in which the brain develops and the order in which it develops. So what we have is this brainstem, or the primitive brain, develops first. So that's then responsible for sensory, motor, and survival skills. Then secondly, we have something called the limbic brain, which develops next, and that's responsible for attachment and emotional development. And finally, we have the cortical brain, which develops last, and that's responsible for our thinking and our learning and language and inhibition. But when a child is exposed to trauma very early in their lives, they may not actually have the language skills to make sense of their experiences. So what this then effectively means is that memories are stuck as sort of sensory memories, and the body has then stored these memories in their sensory systems. So again, thinking about even when you take a trauma history from a child or a young person, they may not always have the language skills to articulate exactly what's happened to them, but we may see trauma that manifests itself in other behaviours that they present with. So what we see is that traumatised children effectively get stuck in what's known as a fear mode as they grow up. They have hypervigilance and sensitivity to danger that's so strong, it actually reduces their ability to kind of filter out other sensory experiences, for example, noises or sights and sounds and smells. And instead, what we find is that their sensory system becomes so overloaded and overwhelmed, they then find it difficult to regulate or to contain their emotions. What we also see with children when they've experienced trauma, and particularly chronic trauma in early childhood, is something called dissociation, which you may already be familiar with this as a concept through your work. But essentially, dissociation is actually a very sophisticated, adaptive coping mechanism and a survival mechanism. And it can be really useful when children are exposed to high levels of trauma and danger that they're able to do this dissociation. It helps children and also adults as well to cope, by enabling them to detach or disconnect between the mind and the body. We often hear about experiences of dissociation in rape cases, for example, when a victim of rape will talk about, during the incident itself, a disconnection between the mind and the body. So an almost out-of-body experience where they know what's happening to their body, but they're not experiencing it. So sometimes the mind can be incredibly helpful at enabling us to survive some of the most horrific things by doing this disconnection work. But what it also means is that even when a child isn't in under threat or isn't in that unsafe place or in danger, they may continue to actually dissociate because they become so used to using this as a survival mechanism. And it may seem that they're lacking in focus or they're not listening. And this is something that we see particularly in schools, where there might be complaints that they're presenting with behavioural problems when in fact they're actually dissociating because they haven't been able to switch off from that primitive part of the brain where everything is focused on their survival and thinking about how they keep themselves safe. So in developmental trauma, we also see an impact on things like patterns of attachments. So children who are exposed to trauma learn very different strategies of attachment, essentially to prevent harm and danger or to keep a parent or caregiver as close as possible. And these strategies are either known as insecure avoidant attachment or insecure preoccupied attachment. Again, we don't need to worry too much about knowing the exact terms, but it can be useful to think about patterns of attachment and just being aware of what these different patterns of attachment might signify. So the first, this insecure avoidant attachment is where children are learning very early on that if they show their feelings, this potentially triggers danger or causes the withdrawal of a parent or a caregiver. And so instead they learn to hide their emotions and then pretend that everything's okay. So inside they might be feeling quite vulnerable and frightened, but they're presenting themselves to the world as absolutely confident, fine, and bright. However, these children may then be triggered later in childhood or even as in adulthood as something stressful happens. So again, we're not clear at that stage because they're so used to hiding their feelings. We don't know how full their glass jar is, which means that if something else happens, their glass jar may very quickly become too full and overflow, and we might see a trauma reaction very quickly that we hadn't been aware was building up. And then in contrast, we have something called insecure preoccupied attachment, which is where children learn the importance of showing their feelings in order to get noticed and to attract attention. And they learn then instead to exaggerate their behaviour, and they can appear angry and hostile and aggressive and quite disruptive on the outside, whilst on the inside, they're actually feeling very frightened, vulnerable and anxious. We also see an impact on what we call emotional regulation. So emotional regulation is a skill which we take for granted, again, that we learn in early childhood. But when children are exposed to trauma, this part of the brain that's responsible for emotional regulation doesn't get that opportunity to develop fully. Because remember, all of the resources are being diverted into just keeping somebody safe when they're stuck in that primitive part of the brain. So instead, what we see is children, young people and adults getting stuck in what's known as this toddler phase. So we often refer to these behaviours as attention seeking. And for anyone who works particularly in educational settings, you may hear teachers in particular talk about attention seeking behaviour. And actually what we need to be doing is thinking about them as attachment seeking behaviours rather than attention seeking. So they're not looking for attention specifically, but they're looking to have some form of attachment because those emotional regulation skills haven't been given that opportunity to develop fully. What we also see with difficulties in terms of regulating emotions is that it can often lead to some quite risky or unhealthy coping strategies. So things like self-harm, drugs and alcohol as ways of regulating emotions, because somebody doesn't have the skills to regulate their own emotions in a way that we all take for granted as we move through our childhood and do that developmental work. This also links to behavioural regulation. So everyone has effectively got a window of tolerance. And when we're in our window of tolerance, we're able to think and learn. But when children have been exposed to trauma, their window of tolerance is actually a lot narrower. And that means that even when we make even small increased demands of them, this can cause them to very quickly move outside of their window of tolerance. And that may then trigger them to become over aroused. So we get a kind of flight or fight response, or under aroused when they shut down completely. So it doesn't take much to move a child or a young person from being in a place where they can cope and they're within their window of tolerance to moving very quickly outside of their window of tolerance. So it's just about that awareness of knowing what's within their window of tolerance and what isn't. So to give an example of that, I've just delivered some trauma-informed practice training to a boxing club. And one of the things that we talked about was when they were giving their kind of instructions to the young people that they were working with, that they might start off with a combination of maybe two punches, and then they'll build it up to three or four punches. But sometimes just going from four punches to a five punch combination can be too much and can cause somebody to kind of move outside of that window of tolerance. So again, just thinking about how you're working with people and at what point that you try and expand that window of tolerance, and at what point you kind of stay within it and strengthen what's happening within that space. Children who've been who've experienced trauma also struggle with underdeveloped cognitive skills. So this, we see then an impact on their ability to do things like plan for the future, to organise themselves, to learn from their mistakes. And they then get stuck in this limbic part of the brain. So they've used all of their energy to stay safe and to work out if they can trust the people around them. It then limits their ability to develop any of those other skills that they might need. So we often see, when children have experienced developmental trauma, quite a chaotic lifestyle, that kind of inability to engage. They might not always attend appointments. They may not always use services consistently. They may be very chaotic, poorly organized. And when you're talking about learning from mistakes or thinking about planning for the future, they may struggle to do that because actually all they can think about is surviving in the here and now. So for example, if we were doing this training in a room all together, and I told you that there was a bomb in the room, and I wasn't going to tell you where that bomb was, and I wasn't going to tell you whether or not it was safe, but for the rest of the day we were going to talk about planning for the future and planning for tomorrow, or what you're going to eat for your dinner tonight, you would find it very difficult to concentrate because you'd be so worried about where this bomb was and at what point it might go off, and what you could do to survive or what you could do to escape. And that's essentially what we're talking about with these children and young people, is that when we're asking them to do work, to think about the future, to change their behaviour, it's almost asking them to do too much because all they can think about is the here and now and getting through the day. We also see an impact on what we call self-concept and identity development. So children who've been exposed to trauma, particularly over a long period of time, are often left with a deep sense of being unlovable, bad and unwanted. And this starts to be how they see themselves, no matter how much reassurance is given by those around them. And this may also then create a vulnerability to exploitation and abuse in relationships. So we may see somebody who's been a victim of some kind of abuse as a child, whether it be sexual abuse, physical abuse, or even domestic violence. And we find that actually they seek to recreate these relationships, or certainly are vulnerable to this exploitation in relationships as they grow up, essentially because it's become what they know, and also what becomes within their normal realm of human experience and what they feel that they deserve, which is where we see a lot of re-victimisation and re-traumatisation in some of the areas where we work. It's really important to say that developmental trauma can be incredibly challenging to work with. Many of the behaviours that we're seeing are often destructive, and they can be incredibly difficult to manage, particularly if we think about in educational settings. I know that there's a lot of schools and teachers that find it incredibly difficult to manage when a child has experienced developmental trauma and those behaviours that they're presenting with. For me, a really good starting point is to understand the cause of that behaviour. So rather than concentrating on the behaviour itself and trying to change that behaviour, taking a step back and remembering that all behaviour is a form of communication, and they're actually trying to tell you something really important about the way that they feel. I'm just going to check in at this stage just to see if there's anything coming up on the chat or if there's any questions about developmental trauma. As I said at the beginning, I'm aware that that's a lot of theory, but it is really important when we're thinking about being trauma-informed that we have that that understanding from the outset about the impact of developmental trauma on children and young people. But just to see if there's anything coming up on the chat or any questions that anyone wants to ask at this stage.
Thanks, Nicola. There is a question in the chat from Lydia saying, can resilience grow with increased trauma? So I think there's a few questions on that. But I mean, also, it's just you've given us a huge amount of information. Probably people are just distilling that at this moment in time. Lydia, did you want to ask that question?
Hi there. I'm just wondering if you've ever found that resilience does grow with an increasing amount of trauma. And if it does, what characterizes the individuals who show that resilience, that increased resilience with pressure? So I work with unaccompanied asylum seeking children, and I've noticed that some young people seem to go through a huge amount and do rather well, and others go through a huge amount and it really decreases their resilience. I suppose what I'm trying to do is work out how can I support young people to grow their resilience? Sorry, there's a lot in that.
No, that's really interesting. And you have preempted my next set of slides, which is wonderful, a wonderful introduction to resilience. So thank you. I think that's a really important point. We often talk in quite negative terms about the impact of trauma, and we might miss resilience and what we call post-traumatic growth. I would say that it can be really difficult to characterise who's going to be more resilient than somebody else. But I also am a big believer that if we work with somebody in the right way, we can foster and promote resilience. And this is where, for me, it's very appealing to think about a trauma-informed approach rather than a trauma-focused approach. So when we think about people coming into our services, rather than focusing on the impact of the trauma, what we focus on is their resilience and their strength and the very fact that they've been able to survive that trauma. And that then becomes the starting point for our engagement with them, that recognition of how they are coping, no matter how they're coping, that recognition that they've been through something unbelievably and unimaginably difficult and horrific and painful, yet here they are surviving and building on that, rather than focusing on what the trauma has taken from them, actually reframing that in much more positive terms about what the trauma has given them in terms of a set of survival skills. Lydia, does that kind of answer the question if I then go on to talk about resilience and how we recognize resilience? Does that help?
That's great, Nicola. Thanks so much.
So this does lead us on to think about reframing some of this kind of negative or dysfunctional behavior that we might see as an impact of trauma, and thinking instead about what we call a strengths-based approach. So I'm going to share something with you called the Battle Mind Model. This was developed in the US by the US military as an educational resource for military personnel and their families. And the idea here is that soldiers, before they deploy to an operational environment like Iraq or Afghanistan, they've become trained in certain survival strategies to help them stay safe and to keep their colleagues alive. So for example, we might see tactical awareness. You can see one of the T's there is tactical awareness as a combat skill. So in combat, survival very much depends on being aware at all times of your surroundings and reacting immediately to sudden changes. But if we take that same combat skill and put it into the home environments, what we find is more problematic. So we see somebody being hypervigilant and they're constantly edgy or anxious. One of the reasons that this is a helpful tool for us to reframe some of the behaviours is that if we imagine that for some of the young people that we work with, they effectively live in a war zone, they actually don't know when it's safe and when it isn't because of the level of trauma that they've been exposed to. So some of the behaviours that they adopt are actually, whilst they are seemingly quite dysfunctional and problematic, if we reframe them in a more strengths-based approach, what we end up with is some really sophisticated survival strategies. So for example, the ability of somebody to go into a room and immediately present themselves as aggressive and assertive, and to immediately suss out who can be trusted and who can't, to know where their exits are. These are actually really good skills. So we might label them as problematic because we know that the place that they've come into is relatively safe, but they're still in that survival mode. So actually their behavior makes perfect sense. So to give an example, when I travel to a hostile environment such as Afghanistan, most often I travel there after a terrorist attack. And so you arrive and they show you to your room and they tell you that if you hear a particular noise, you should hide underneath your bed and wait for help. And if you hear another noise, you should run because it means that we're being attacked and you need to get to a place of safety. And then they ask you to keep your body armor by your bed and to put your bag there and your passport and your trainers so that you can run very quickly if you need to in the night. Now, I don't know about any of you, but I'm not going to sleep then. I'm going to stay awake through the night. If I do drift off to sleep, I'm going to wake up to every single tiny noise because I don't want to lose those precious few moments waking up when I could be keeping myself safe and surviving something. So in Afghanistan, those behaviours make perfect sense. Now, when I go back to my nice house in Yorkshire, where it's nice and quiet and in the countryside, and I still can't sleep and I'm still waking up with every little noise, those behaviours make less sense. So when we're thinking about people's coping strategies, rather than judging their coping strategies, we need to see everything that they're doing, whether it be self-harming or using drugs and alcohol, as actually very sophisticated ways of surviving and coping. And thinking about these as strengths for us to build on, rather than things for us to say need to be repaired or exchanged. So one of the things that's been particularly appealing about the model is that for many many young people living in London, particularly in some of the more deprived areas where they're from very vulnerable backgrounds, they are effectively living in a war zone and they have developed some very good combat skills to survive in this war zone. And if we shift them slightly, we can see these coping strategies as assets and positive qualities rather than things that are wrong with them. And then we might start to ask questions around when are those behaviours less helpful. But our starting point needs to be identifying that these behaviours are actually really helpful to somebody. They're helping somebody to survive. And that's where we're starting to think about resilience and starting to recognise that resilience. So for me, this idea of developing resilience really comes from that place of recognition to start with. But what we also see is people whose glass jars are actually very full. And they might have less space at the top that becomes their resilience. But we also see people whose assumptions of the world being safe and good have been shattered, but they have managed to develop a worldview that helps them to keep them safe. And when somebody has a lot of trauma in their glass jar, what it effectively says to them is that they can cope and that they're a survivor and that they can deal with anything. And they learn very good coping strategies, which is where we see the resilience. And I think the refugee example is a really good example of that, where we see that people have been through some incredibly difficult things and they've come through the other side, but they've emerged not the same person they were before the trauma, but actually a different person after the trauma. They're actually stronger and more resilient than they were before. One of the things that's important to mention is that healthy adaptation to trauma is absolutely possible. We have all been through times in our lives when we have experienced difficult or adverse experiences, and we might notice that in the immediate aftermath, the first few hours or days or even weeks after something difficult has happened, we're thinking about it quite a bit. It feels quite painful. We're ruminating on it. We're a little bit stuck. But if we think about the mind's information processing system, when it works efficiently, what we would have noticed is that gradually over a few days or even a few weeks, it starts to be less painful. We start to say things like, I'm glad that happened because it's taught me X, Y, and Z, and we start to move on from it. So this means that our brain's information processing system is working efficiently, and that useful information is extracted from that experience, and then the negative parts of those experiences are discarded. So if we think about the brain's information processing system being like the digestive system. So when we give our digestive system food, it's really good at extracting the valuable nutrients from the food and discarding the toxic waste. And when it's working well, it does that without us even needing to think about it. But if we give our digestive system too much food, if we give it too much sugar or too much alcohol or too much food at Christmas, we might notice that our digestive system slows itself right down and it becomes sluggish, and we may also experience digestive problems. And the brain's information processing system works in the same way. If we give it too much traumatic material, it slows itself right down and it gets itself a bit stuck. And it plays out that traumatic material again and again to try and extract the useful parts and get rid of the negative parts. Now, it's not necessarily problematic that it slows itself right down. It means that processing work that needs to be done is being done, but it can sometimes be very difficult while that processing work is being done, because what we see is that all of the resources that are normally available to us to do other things, like remember things, focus on other activities, make sense of experiences, retain information, all of those things, all of those resources get diverted to doing that processing work. But what we do see is not only resilience, but we do see adaptation to trauma. So to give an example, I worked on a hostage case last year with two female students who were taken hostage in West Africa. And my job was to meet them after they were released and escort them back to their families. And the return journey took about 18 hours and it was across two different flights. And it's very rare when you're doing clinical trauma work to have such a prolonged period of time with people in the immediate aftermath of the traumatic incident. And it gave me a really unique insight into how quickly that processing happened for them. And how their needs and the things that they were using to make sense of their experiences changed very quickly over the hours and days that followed, and really reminded me of that kind of resilience and that capacity to cope with things and to adjust to some of the most challenging and painful of experiences. And this leads us to think about things like post-traumatic growth, which is something that we often see in refugees, not only that resilience and that capacity to cope, but to take it one step further and to think about post-traumatic growth. What we mean by post-traumatic growth is the experience of positive adjustment which results from how a person responds to and rebuilds their lives following exposure to trauma. So when someone is exposed to continuous trauma, what we find is that they might choose the path of assuming control in a much more constructive manner. So I've included a photograph here of the Assyrian white helmets. So for any of you who's aware of the Syrian white helmets, they were in the media a couple of years ago quite a lot during the height of the Syrian conflict when it was being covered by the media. And these were effectively a group of volunteers who formed a kind of volunteer search, rescue and emergency response service and got involved with other community engagement initiatives. So for me, their work isn't even just post-traumatic growth, it's actually traumatic growth in the sense that they wanted to retain some kind of control over their environment despite the daily bombardment of airstrikes. They wanted to create something better in their environment. And for me, this really represents this idea of post-traumatic or traumatic growth, this idea of building something back even stronger. And as you can see, the photograph is them planting flowers on the streets in Syria, this idea of wanting to kind of promote hope and optimism for the future, and just thinking about their level of resilience, but also that capacity for traumatic growth as a result of the experiences that they'd had. I'm just going to check in to see if there's any more questions that are coming up before I move on to the final part about thinking about our own self-care and our psychological resilience. But just see if there's any questions coming up around post-traumatic growth or how we might start to adopt a more strengths-based approach by recognising psychological resilience in those that we're working with and really tapping into that as our starting point for engagement.
Does anybody have any urgent questions at the moment? I know there was one in the chat, Nicola, which was about clinical treatments for developmental trauma. I don't know if that's something you'd want to pick up on now, or that's something you want to pick up a bit later.
I'll just make a quick note of it, and I can come back to that at the end, if that's okay.
Can I ask a quick question, Nicola?
Of course.
Yeah. I've been doing some research with young Black and dual heritage young people around identity. And I just wanted to ask if you would describe the kind of ongoing psychological weathering that many young people from the BAME community face because of structural racism as a form of trauma.
Yes, I would regard that as a trauma for a form of trauma, if that's how they were making sense of it for themselves. So I think the one of the interesting things that comes up around racism that's come up previously is around the language that we use in terms of oppression, and again what's been taken away from people when we're thinking about racism, as opposed to what it might have given people in terms of their being able to develop that strength and resilience. So I would certainly see the connections that in itself is a form of trauma, but I would also be saying that there's differences within that in terms of how it's been interpreted. So that we wouldn't necessarily say that everybody will exhibit a trauma response as a result of that structural racism, but when we're thinking about the collective, we may well see that as a response. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
I'll just finish up with the final part of the presentation, then come back to the question on clinical treatments for developmental trauma and try and answer that as best as I can, and then just see if there's any more questions either coming up in the chat or if anyone else has anything else that they want to sort of talk through. This is really one of the most important points when we're thinking about being trauma-informed. We can't ask you to be trauma-informed if you're not being trauma-informed in how you look after yourself and thinking about your own psychological resilience, and that recognition that when we're working with trauma, regardless of what context we're working in, there are some very clear risks and also rewards of working with trauma. So some of the very kind of potential rewards include that ability to make a difference to people at their most vulnerable. And I know that when I'm doing trauma work, for me, that's the thing that very much keeps me engaged, no matter how difficult the work is. That idea that you are with people at the time that they are most vulnerable, and you, it's a privilege to be present in those moments when they're at their most vulnerable, but also the capacity to make a difference, no matter how small, is the thing that for me keeps me very much engaged with the work. Really seeing the impact of your support. Again, even if the rewards are limited in terms of the impact of what you're actually able to achieve, seeing that impact can be incredibly powerful. That ability to build some trusting relationships, and you may be building relationships with people who've not had that opportunity before, whether you're working with refugees or whether you're working with other parts of the community and other vulnerable people. You may be the first person in that child or young person's life that you're able to build that trusting relationship with. However, in amongst the rewards, we also do see some risks about working with trauma. So one of the main risks is around something called compassion fatigue, which is exactly as it sounds, and it's characterized by that physical and emotional exhaustion and a profound decrease in the ability to provide care and empathy and support. So what we sometimes see is this kind of idea of burnout, where you become very tired from engaging with somebody's trauma and from providing that support. The other thing that we also may see is something called vicarious trauma. So what effectively happens is when we engage with traumatic experiences of those we're working with, there's the potential that their trauma becomes our trauma and we experience its effects firsthand. And again, thinking about the context of COVID-19, where we've moved to remote delivery of support, not only is there the potential that their trauma becomes our trauma, but there's also the potential that we bring their trauma into our own homes because we're working from home and we're working remotely. So for me, one of the biggest challenges that I found about shifting to work remotely, much of my work was done face-to-face previously. I wasn't used to working remotely. But the biggest shift for me is that some of those rewards of working with trauma have been reduced because you're not able to see the effects of the work that you're doing. And sometimes you can feel quite frustrated and quite overwhelmed by a sense of helplessness that you're only able to do so much remotely. At the same time, those risks, those rewards have gone down at the same time that the potential risks have gone up. So just thinking always about that balance between what do we get from doing this work? How does it benefit us? How does it, what are those rewards that keep us invested? But also, when do those rewards outweigh the risks and vice versa? And just being very mindful of keeping that balance between the risks and rewards of trauma. Some of the coping strategies for self-care. What I'm not going to do is to tell you what you should be doing, because I think it's really important that everybody develops their own self-care strategies and they do what works for them rather than what I say should work for you. So I know my own personality is such that people are continually telling me that I should be doing mindfulness or meditation, and that just doesn't work for me. And actually, I'd rather go to the gym, or on a bad day, I'd rather sit in front of the telly and eat chocolate than think about being mindful. So it's about taking the time to pay attention to your own needs and feelings. Trying where you can to maintain some kind of routine around your work, particularly if you're working remotely and working from home. I know that there's been, for me, certainly in the early stages of the lockdown, a real blurring of boundaries where you're still working at 10 o'clock at night to kind of compensate for those periods in the day when you've perhaps not been as productive, and starts to blur the boundary between home and work life. As I said, engaging in those activities that you enjoy and find relaxing, doing what you want to do rather than what you feel you should do or what other people tell you is best for you to do. Things like exercising regularly can be really helpful. And I'm not necessarily talking about going to the gym or out for a run if you don't want to, but just getting some fresh air and going for a walk can be really good. Trying to regulate things like your sleep can often be really helpful. Setting some very realistic goals. And again, that links back to doing activities that you enjoy and you find relaxing and helpful rather than doing things that other people think you should do. So being really realistic in what you can actually achieve. And ultimately, the most important thing is enacting some of that kindness that you enact to those that you work with and diverting that to yourself. So looking after yourselves and being kind to yourself, and not giving yourself a hard time when perhaps you fall short of some of the things that you want to be doing. Just before we finish, I'm just going to do a bit of an introduction to session two so you have an idea of what we're going to cover in session two. So this is going to focus much more specifically on trauma-informed practice and what this actually means within our individual and organisational practice. I'm going to be looking at the six trauma-informed principles to practice and then how we integrate them as part of our practice. I'm going to be drawing on something called the SENSE model to help to structure some trauma-informed interventions. I'm aware that you're working in a range of different contexts, so this may not be relevant to everybody. But if anyone's looking at delivering support over an ongoing period or even over a single session, we've been using the SENSE model across a range of different organisations, from kind of rape crisis, traumatic bereavement, and working with child victims of crime and victims of terror, to think about structuring some trauma-informed interventions, which give a kind of clear focus for each session when we're doing that support work. And just to come back to any questions, if somebody asked specifically about clinical treatments for developmental trauma, I don't know if the person who asked that question wanted to kind of elaborate on the sort of thing that you wanted to know about there before I answer it more broadly.
Hi Nicola, yes it was me, and I've actually done this course the wrong way around because I've already done your session too, but I realised I'd missed this intro session, so I wanted to sit in on this as well. But it just struck me, some of the young people I work with haven't had any clinical treatment, and just what is the best. I mean, I recognised a lot of the characteristics when you were talking about developmental trauma, and what is the best treatment. I mean, I'm not a clinician by any means. I'm a youth practitioner, but what could we be recommending to them, or what should we trying to, what services should we be seeking out for them?
So I guess we'd be thinking about some of the clinical treatments. Well, I mean, they really vary, but what we're looking to do is to support and to stabilise. So we may get some trauma-focused treatments, so things like cognitive behavioural therapy and trauma-focused cognitive behavioural therapy. There's another type of therapy called dialectical behavioural therapy, or DBT, that's often recommended as best practice. There's also other types of therapies, such as things like play therapy or creative arts therapy or even art therapy, that can be a really good way of engaging with people and starting to look at how we can develop some of those cognitive and socialization skills. So there's a lot of clinical treatments out there. Part of the ongoing challenge for all of us is how accessible these treatments are. So how easy it is to get a referral into child and adolescent mental health services to do this type of work, or how easy it is to get a referral to indeed any kind of mental health services. So we might want to think beyond clinical treatments and actually the type of work that we can do, even being non-clinical, what you're able to do with somebody and how you're able to focus on developing some of those skills, developing those relationships with them, providing them with a safe space to explore how they're coping, to recognise some of that resilience and to think differently about some of the behaviours that they've developed, so that we start to use words like assets and good qualities, positive qualities, and reframe some of those behaviours. So all of that work can be done around those kind of clinical interventions as well. But there are a range of clinical interventions, but unfortunately, a lot of access to clinical interventions for developmental trauma will be based on the level of risk that somebody presents with. So if you're making a referral into mental health services, the likelihood is, unless there's a significant level of risk of harm to self or to others, they're unlikely to receive a service under the NHS unless it's a specialist kind of commission service, which makes it then very difficult to know where to start with developmental trauma. And of course, if we leave developmental trauma untreated, when these young people reach adulthood, we start to relabel it as personality disorder instead. And again, personality disorder can be very difficult to work with and to treat. Does that help at all?
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I don't know if you can see the chat, but quite a few of us are saying that it's just the issue around access. So, I mean, I've had people that were in crisis that were definitely a risk, very high risk. And I struggled, I battled to get services and support for them. So unfortunately, that's just an ongoing issue.
Yes. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I'm looking to do through this series of presentations is, whilst we should still be advocating for those services and we should still be pushing to get access to those services because that's what the people that we're working with need, but I also want to give all of you a sense of confidence that the support that you're giving these young people is, when it's trauma-informed, can be incredibly useful as well. So yes, of course, there's a place for clinicians here, but it's also about not underestimating the work that you can do even as a non-clinician to support people and to create a lasting impact and a lasting change on their lives as well.
Nicola, can I just come in just very briefly, because I think, I mean, you know, I've just been looking it is incredibly challenged to get young people into services. One of the things that I think we could all be better at is with the COVID response, is what's happening across London and other regions, is that they're setting up both a transition and a recovery process. And mental health is identified in every single one of those strands. And I think that we probably need to have some conversations, and maybe not within this session, but another session, where we look at how do we engage with some of those structures to start flagging up some of those issues. Because we did a piece of work, a very small piece of work with TikTok, where the young people did a sort of youth listening project, and they presented to the Children and Young People's Mental Health Transformation Board. I think there's a greater level of willingness at the moment to have some conversations about how do we move away from those traditional CAMHS models to get more work happening out in communities. But also funders are also really interested in this as well. So I think we kind of have to use COVID as an opportunity really to start pushing and shoving some of these conversations all over the place. And I know that I've looked at the recovery process for London, where mental health across all groups is a key issue, but also the Youth Recovery Mission for London has got mental health as an area in it. And I think actually what we need to be doing is putting a lot more pressure on some of those structures to change how things are happening. You've also got work at DfE happening in terms of the mental health trailblazers in schools, where they're putting mental health practitioners in schools. So I think there's an opportunity for us, A, to be pushing those other services to look slightly differently, but also to start pushing what some of the youth sector is doing in this space and being really high profile about it. So I think there's some conversations that we could follow up as we go forward about where can we put some leverage and influence in some of this at the moment. And nationally, they're looking at some funding coming out around young people. There's a bigger profile on young people now than I've ever seen, which is great. But I think also there's a piece of work happening across all the government departments to look at what's happening around mental health. So I think there are some opportunities that we need to sort of grab hold of and push as much as we possibly can.
Is there any more questions that people have got or questions that have come up in the chat that would be useful to address? All very quiet now. As I said, I will, after we've completed the evaluation, then I will stay online. So if anyone wants to chat with a smaller audience, then I'll stay online as everybody leaves. And the other thing as well is that my my contact details are on the PowerPoint slides and on the in the trauma manual. So if you think of questions between the series of sessions and you just want to email and ask for some more information or for some advice, or want me to cover something specific in the next session, then do feel free to drop me an email so that that's being done as well. Sharon, do you need me to stop sharing so you can go back to the evaluation? Is that right?
Yes, please. If everybody could just stay on just for a couple of minutes. A, for a start, Nicola has very kindly offered to stay here and answer people's direct questions. What I'd quite like to do is just gather a bit of, we made the mistake before of sending out like an email with an evaluation form, and I know everybody is incredibly busy. So what we're going to do is very quickly go back to our Mentimeter. And I'd quite like you to give us some feedback on some of these questions. Now, for us, it's quite vital because we do get funded by City Bridge Trust and they ask us what difference any of this makes, which is a really valid question to ask. And so if you could go back onto Mentimeter, and I'd quite like you just, we've got three questions just to help us and also Nicola think through the impact of this training. And it's only three questions. And then if you can just give us 5 minutes just to do these questions, then Nicola is here and she's going to stay on for another 20 minutes or so to ask individual questions. And I know, I think it was Martin asked a question, which probably would be really good to have in a minute, which is about if we don't deal with our own trauma, how can we help other young people? So
if you go on the Mentimeter
and do this for us, that would be great. And it's just a very quick way of us getting some feedback. And then also thinking about how do we shape the next lot of training sessions that we're putting on. I'll carry on talking while this is happening. Is if you haven't already signed up for the rest of the sessions, please do. If you find out they're full, and I think Rhianne might be on this call with Naomi, Nicola has been phenomenal and we're getting a lot of people interested in this. We're going to run a second series anyway, so if you can't do it, don't worry. Likewise, if you get other people who are really interested in doing the training, then let us know, and then what we will do is just, we'll just keep on advertising and publicising those sessions as well. So if people could very quickly do this for us, it would be fantastic, because it gives us a good understanding of, and also what else we need to do in this space as well.
Sorry, can I just ask quickly, how do I access this meter?
If you're on your phone, you're on your phone, Nadine.
I'm on a laptop.
Okay, so if you go to menti.com, on your laptop, if you could open up a tab, and if you use, when you get on it, it's 3501462, but I'll say it again once you've got the tab open. So it's menti.com, and then it asks you for the code, and the code is 3501462. Has everybody had a chance to participate? I'll give it a couple more seconds. We're trying to find the quickest and easiest ways to gather feedback. Mentimeter seems to be our preferred option at the moment, but we're really happy. The other thing I would say is if you've got any other comments that you want to share with us, then please come offline, email us, and we'll pick those up as well. Right, I'm going to move on. We've got two more questions. Is that all right to move on? Does anybody need me to hold on for a minute? Okay, thank you. So the first one about psychological trauma, and the second one is about developmental trauma. So if you could do the same for that, that would be really good. And then we just got one open box question in terms of what stuff you would like as we move forward. People haven't signed up for our update. I think Rhianne posted it in the chat, but I can do it again in a minute. Is we have a free weekly newsletter, which is a policy and practice update newsletter. And that just gives you opportunities in terms of all the training that's happening, anything else that's going on. Things that are coming up in the future is we're going to have a series of sessions around attached youth work and how to undertake attached youth work. And I know within that, they're also really keen to think about looking at a trauma-informed approach around that, and so there'll be some work happening on that. And we've also got quite a lot of safeguarding training happening. And then Sandra Bassiano, who's on the call, is also looking at doing some very, very targeted work around looking at the impact of COVID-19 on young people from the African diaspora. And so she also will be advertising a range of different training sessions and support for organisations as well. So there'll be quite a lot coming up, and please, we're trying to do this online because we actually think it's easier for people to access this in terms of coming up for a whole day's training. We do realise that also full day's training are actually really useful for people as well. So I'm going to move on now to the next slide, and then perhaps people could ask questions as the other people are filling in. So if anybody's got specific questions for Nicola, is so the last one is just, it's open box really, just any key issues that you want to focus on moving forward. We really use this to try and think about what training we're going to put on next. So if there's anything that you really want us to focus in on, let us know and just fill those boxes in. And in the meantime, if people have got any questions they want to ask Nicola, I'm sure Nicola's completely up for those conversations. That's the doorbell.
And that's my dog now started as well, because she's missing happening.
Barking all over the country. We did have a cat on a call earlier on, didn't we, Sandra, which was quite funny because it did sound like a baby screaming somewhere, and we were like, oh my gosh, what's going on with the cat? So anybody got any particular questions that they'd like to ask Nicola?
I know that I've got one from Martin, I think, in the chat. So he says, if we've not addressed our own trauma, can that inhibit our ability to support vulnerable young people dealing with their own trauma? That's a really big question. I would say potentially, but not necessarily, which I realise doesn't entirely answer the question. I think when we have our own stuff, as long as we have awareness of its impact on us, and we have that time and space to reflect on it, then it doesn't necessarily preclude us from working with other people and their trauma. But it is just about making sure that we look after our own self-care and think about places where we could be triggered. So with that, I would be saying it doesn't mean you can't work with other people's trauma, but I'd be encouraging you to have a lot of support around and thinking about things like reflective practice, so that you could be thinking about the impact of other people's trauma and what might get triggered in yourself, and where possible, I guess, encouraging you to focus on your own support needs as well as those that you're working with. I don't know, Martin, if that answers the question or if you wanted to kind of elaborate on what your thoughts were around that question.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. I've just encountered a woman who does work in South Africa with social workers. And she explores the notion of wounding and healing. She does group work with social workers and discovers that many of them either are unaware that they have experienced some kind of trauma and are wounded and need some self-healing, or they don't have that space. And her work is about creating space for people to identify and address their own needs, and I think that's really important.
Great, thank you.
Really picking up on the resilience and support around developing resilience. In terms of the detached youth work, if you haven't seen it already, on the website we've got a series of 4 training sessions, and I know somebody was talking about their young advisors getting involved in it, so that's completely open to some of those groups. So if you haven't checked out the website already, please do. And you can also just sign up for our update, which I'm just going to post one more time because I know sometimes it's really hard to follow the chat through. But sign up for the update, and then work that's going to come out, like the work Sandra is going to be leading on, is that will all be advertised via those sources. So, and it's completely free for everybody. Any other questions for Nicola while you've got a chance?
Hey Nicola, I put a question in the chat there, but I'm not sure if you've seen it.
I'm just coming across it now. About trauma in the environment. Yes, yeah, go for it.
So, I mean, I was wondering if, what sort of impact the environment has on how a young person processes trauma. Like, if something like acts of violence is normalized in a community, then does that kind of, in general, does that increase resilience to trauma, or is it to the point where traumatic experience or experiences within that community become so normalized that resilience isn't really even a factor in that any longer, if you know what I'm saying? So sometimes young people I'm working with, they'll talk about traumatic, really traumatic events as if they're just an everyday experience.
Yes, so what we find when we end up not with traumatized individuals but traumatized communities,
yeah,
and so we see some real problems within those communities in the sense of they become really hard to engage with, they become really mistrustful, and there's a kind of legacy of trauma that builds up within that community. So to a certain extent there is resilience because we are seeing people survive and continue to cope with that level of trauma because it's become normalized, but we also do see some problematic behaviors because what's happened is that we've ended up with a whole community that's traumatized. So when we go in to do our engagement work or when we go in to offer support services, there's a lot more resistance and it's a lot more difficult to affect change within those communities because they are traumatized and effectively close themselves down. So a lot of the work that I've done with organisations working in Iraq have this problem that there's huge legacies, there's a huge legacy of trauma, and what we end up in Iraq, within Iraq and Afghanistan in particular, is kind of a lot of traumatised communities, which make it then very difficult to start to build in specific initiatives and community engagement. Is that something that sounds familiar from the place where you're working?
Yeah. I mean, I would say it depends on the individual. So I would say that a lot of my experience is the young person doesn't, they're not even willing to process the fact that it is a traumatic event, because the event is so normal.
Yes. You know what I'm
saying? So even beyond work, like you could probably tell from my accent, I'm from Belfast, and like in my community we have like the highest suicide rate in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I remember growing up, it was just so normal to know people who had hanged themselves. And
yes.
It wasn't it wasn't something that people, if someone had come to me as a teenager and said, you know, we want to unpack this traumatic experience, I'd have been like, what traumatic experience? And that's what I'm finding here. I want to unpack the fact that your friend's been stabbed, or that you've just come out of prison, or that you've been kidnapped. They're like, what are you talking about? You know, it's not so much resilience to it as acceptance almost.
Yes, yeah. And I think then what we see is we see people's coping strategies that people don't necessarily acknowledge it as a trauma, but we still see some coping strategies which demonstrate to us that it is a trauma. So that kind of mistrust of people, kind of being suspicious of how you keep yourself safe. So that indicates a level of trauma, but the very idea of being able to say, we need to recognise this as a trauma, is very difficult. So in those kind of situations, I would be looking at giving them some education about trauma more broadly, rather than linking it to individual situations if they can't associate it with trauma. So you might start to have conversations about other types of traumas, for example, a terrorist incident, something that's more established as a traumatic incident. You might just have conversations about signs and symptoms and behaviours and its impact, and see if anything there kind of rings true for people, rather than specifically saying, this is a trauma that we need to focus on and unpack. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. That's really helpful. Yeah.
Is there any other questions that are coming up? As I said, I'm aware that I've covered a lot of theory today. So if there's anything that comes up before the next session, just drop me an email, or feel free to save questions for the next session for those that are booked in to ask them there as well. We've always left plenty of time for questions and discussion.
Thanks, Nicola. I think that's been really helpful. And I think actually, you know, having this series of session really helps, gives us time to sort of distill the information, think about things, and then come back again. So that sounds really good. In terms of the resources, what we're going to do is you'll get an email out tomorrow with the handbook that Nicola's created, but also these slides and all the information. So that will all come up to you. And then you'll if you haven't checked already, check online, and then you'll be able to access all the different sessions that are happening coming up. I think there's a question, Nicola, about what sessions 3 and 4 cover, if you're happy to cover that quickly.
Yes, let me just find the PowerPoint. Session 3 is around therapeutic skills and creative ways of working. So we'll be looking at kind of some of those key skills to actually integrate a trauma-informed approach, and also I'll be looking at some creative ways of kind of getting people to engage in conversations and share how they've been, again, not being focused on the trauma specifically, but on a trauma-informed approach. And then the final session is around how we sort of make a commitment to becoming trauma-informed, what that actually looks like in terms of our individual practice. And session 4 has some breakout rooms as well, so there'll be much more of an opportunity in session 4 to kind of share different ideas and network with colleagues and share some areas of practice there.
Fantastic. Thanks, Nicola. So thanks for joining, everybody, and hopefully you've all got something really useful out of today, and join up for the next ones. And it's been really good to have this conversation. And Nicola, you know, I've seen some of this stuff before, but every time I learn something new, every time you come at it from a different perspective. So, and I think there was a really good, interesting question there about, you know, are the rest of the services looking at a trauma-informed approach? And I think probably there's something for all of us about having that conversation at every single environment we're at to start talking about this, so that everybody is really clear about how that's happening. And I think there's an opportunity to start influencing the agenda a bit more now in terms of what we're going to do. So keep your eyes on the training, and if there's anything else you need, please let us know and we'll try and pick it up. Oh, and also the recordings, yes, we have done a recording. That will be put up online as well, so you can listen to it. But I think there's recordings from the previous sessions on top as well, already online. But Rhianne knows much more about that than I do. All right, then. Nice to meet everybody, and we'll speak to you soon.